Yes, indeed. Let's welcome Chris and Andy, and let's say good morning. Hope you had a good week.
Yes, we. It's another wonderful Saturday, Mr. Brett.
Yeah,
Andy.
Exactly. Yeah, they sure fly by, don't they? This time of the year, you know, everything, so much, you know, with weather and open houses and people deciding should we list now or in the spring. And boy, I tell you, it just it's always a variety this time of the year. It's a lot of fun.
I think it is one of the things, you know, you get into a listing in this time of year. I think the hardest part for a lot of people is the wait.
Yeah.
You know, waiting for the showings. The showings typically slow down, but the showings are typically better as well. You know, there's people that are coming, they're actually really looking and, you know, trying to get a house. But what do you think, where do you see from your clients the hardest part is when as the house is listed?
Mm-hmm.
And then in the waiting process, what do you think the hardest part
is? You know, a lot of us put a lot of time into the front end of getting a house ready for sale. And we're getting prepared. We're, you know, cleaning carpets or replacing carpets and painting and maybe freshening up the kitchen with hardware or new lighting or whatever it might be. And then also we put it on the market and then we're waiting and sitting there waiting. Okay, did we not do enough? You know, did we overprice it? And so you start second guessing yourself. And so I think that, you know, one of the best things to do is make sure that you understand the market you're in. And if you're in a market where it's very competitive, I always recommend you take your agent and say, hey, let's go look at what we consider to be our three biggest competitors.
And when you mean competitive, you mean there's other listings at that price point?
Let's say all the two stories in your – let's say you live up in my neck of the woods. So you're in Blaine, and there's a bunch of, you know, 2,600 square foot two stories, four bedrooms up, three-car garage on nice city lots, and everybody's priced at $450. And so what ends up happening is if you get to the point of where your house is at $465 just to see if you can get it, and just you're going to try it, but everybody else is at $450, and now you go on the market at that price, all you're doing is helping somebody else sell, and then you may even just sit there. Because the Minnesota Nice, they're passive aggressive. They're not going to come out and just lowball you. They literally will just avoid you and go to the better values.
And I think sometimes in a price segment also, what happens is there's just not much going at all.
Right.
You know, and it's one of those things that you either got to wait them out so for that market to kind of hit, or you got to go chase the market.
Right.
And I think that's what happens when some markets get nailed hard is when someone says, you know what, I got to get out of here. Then all of a sudden they take a low price.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, I mean, you kind of got a decision. I mean, some realtors can usually figure it out, like, and here's the other thing. You don't really figure it out until 60 days later when it closes. But realtors can typically figure out the same. You know what? That one was just that some serious motivation there, and that one went down. That's just that's not normal.
Right.
You know, but you got to, as a house that's on the market that's competing against something like that, you got to deal with that, or at least you got to know about it, you know, so you can explain it and justify it to a potential buyer.
Well, it's a beauty contest. The prettiest house at the best price is the one that goes next. And I think that there's, or if you want to look at it from a value perspective, which house has the most value to offer for that fair price? Because someone that's in that same price range and they look at side by side, does this house have a better view? Does this have a bigger backyard? Does this have the fire pit included? You know, I mean, literally the pavers and everything where they've spent a couple $1,000 making something nice that you'll appreciate as a buyer. And you may choose that house over that because all things else may be considered equal. You know, maybe they're real similar styles. Maybe they're similar quality levels. Maybe they're, you know, but that's, you know, it's so subjective to the buyer. But like I always say, put the odds in your hands with making sure the house is prepared to sell. You put all the marketing effort into it, and then you price it at a fair price, and you're going to win.
Yeah, and I think when you're talking about pricing with people, I think what they need to understand is that what happens if you don't price it right and you sit on the market? I mean, and the things that happen are that every day, every bed's got to be made. All the dishes got to be put away. Everything's got to look perfect for that potential buyer that's going to be coming that day. And I think that's a real big frustration part with people that have their house on the market because that's what they're constantly doing.
Right.
You know.
Well, and you know, the other thing I think is when the fall market's here, generally, you know, there's less houses on the market. Well, this fall, we just talked about this last week, there's actually, we're up about 15% roughly, give or take, depending on the pocket you're living in, of more inventory for sale this year than there was last year at this exact same time. So there is more for sale in each price range usually, or in each price range here. So what we're looking at is there's a little more competition this fall than what we're normally used to seeing, which gives the illusion that it has become a buyer's market from a seller's market because of the inventory that's available. So people are going out and they're like, yeah, there is five or six houses to go see versus in the summertime. Most people in their price ranges would only have one or two to look at. You'd have to make a quick decision because it would go pending if you didn't.
Yeah, true. You know, today Jeff Zwiefel with M&Z Law Firm is going to be with us today. We're going to do some talking, maybe get some legal advice for Jeff because we can't do that, right, Andy?
Yes.
Yeah. we do.
We
for
want
instance,
to.
This is what
Trust
happened
me.
With a client of ours. Yeah. But you know, Andy's very smart in all aspects of life, and rumor has it in real estate, there's a difference with the daylight savings time.
Yeah.
Is that what happens during our daylight savings time
when
it comes to real estate?
You well, know? You know, funny you should ask, Chris. I pulled some stats for us here. The what in the fall, what a difference an hour makes, and this is because this week we fell back an hour. And in the housing market, this is nationally here. This was by National Association of Real Estate Agents. Every hour in the U.S., 614 homes sell.
Jeez.
So 1 hour, that's think about that. That's 600 people getting their houses sold. 95 houses regain positive equity. We're still not out of that, you know, slump yet of people coming back, especially as prices have started to
not
kind
completely,
of,
but it's
we're real close. Yeah. I mean, real close. But I mean, there's still some of those pockets where, you know, when you were building something very exceptional, you know, that those values are not back. And there's always going to be examples of that. But the average median home price goes up $1.38 a hour.
Wow. So now we're going to go back to your little latte example. Remember you had a latte example?
Yeah.
So we're thinking, how much are lattes again? I don't even know. I don't drink them.
You're hot.
We're
going
to say they're like $4.
Five. Yeah.
Okay. So every 3 hours, your house goes up. You can afford a latte and stay with it.
That's why I tell people to buy houses, Chris.
Yeah, exactly.
If you're thirsty.
Brilliant, isn't it? Let's go to Jeff.
Speaking
Jeff,
of
how many lawsuits happened within an hour in the United States?
You know, Chris, I haven't researched it.
See, Andy probably knows.
How many am I in or how many
you? Let's talk about short sales, though. Short sales is something that, was very prevalent. I mean, it was huge. But they're still happening out there.
You know, they really are, Chris. I've actually seen somewhat of an uptick this fall in the number of new short sale appointments I have.
Mm. And what do you think's feeding that?
Well, I think it's a lot of what you guys have been talking about is that there may be a little bit more competition for sellers. Mm-hmm. And some of these people have probably had their home on the market already, seen that they weren't able to get what we would consider more market price. And now they're looking at they're going to need to do a short sale because they would now end up short on being able to pay their mortgage if they sell for less.
So if someone was coming in and they have an appointment, that's what happens, right? They come in and get a consultation from you to see kind of where they sit in the whole situation.
Yeah, absolutely. We just go over step by step how it would work if they pursue a short sale, but then look at other options they have to dispose of the property.
Yeah. You know. Are they typically have already talked to an agent and that agent's told them, hey, it's only worth this, or have they like failed at that price and had it on the market and just say, you know?
You know, I think it's almost all of them are referrals from agents, and some have just for the first time did a look at the house and say, we're probably going to be below enough to clear, you know, to cover the costs. And others have been on the market for a while and they say, well, now you have to decide to market this as a short sale. And so the agent asks, do you want to pursue that? Because I believe they market it differently at that point.
Well, I think it detours buyers coming in because they now have to exhibit patience, you know, and kind of show we have to go through the due diligence process. But what I'm real curious with, Jeff, is that right now we seem to have, you know, fairly decent, you know, employment situations. And so someone coming in that wants to do a short sale, they still don't always get a short sale. I mean, they have to demonstrate the ability to not pay and they have to. So, you know, can they get by with, you know, just having a lot of consumer debt, or what are some of the biggest reasons you're seeing that this is happening again?
Well, I think it's that there's even with a much better economy, there still is a certain number of people that be based on illness or injury or job loss or relocation, divorce, they have a life change and they're not prepared for it as far as their home being able to sell for enough, but they're more or less forced to sell for one reason or another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's not like they spent all their money and they have their credit cards jacked up and they're just selling their house because they don't have any equity there. Because I think that was always the fear, is that people were doing these cash out refis, spending the money, you know, foolishly, and then all of a sudden they're in a negative equity position because of their spending habits. I think this is where you're talking about real life happening, where it's real life situations and they just need help.
Yeah. Really, they do. And in today's market, they don't realize that that's still a viable option.
Yeah. Oh, Danny wants a break. We'll talk more about it after the next segment here.
And welcome back to the Real Estate Show here on WCCO. And here again, Chris and Andy.
Okay, we're back. Jeff Sweefel with MNZ Law. We're talking a little about short sales when we went to the break. And one of the things that I wanted to say was that what I'm seeing is, I don't think it's that they don't have the equity. It's they don't have the funds to be able to get the house ready for sale. And then at that point, I mean, and you know this, Andy, mm-hmm. I mean, if we're putting in, you know, 15,000, you know, you probably make 30,000. But if you don't put that 15,000 in, you might lose 50,000. Are you seeing that happening, Jeff?
Absolutely, Chris. And it is a matter of houses that need work, need updates. A lot of these people were still people that bought the homes back in the 2005, 6, 7 range, and really haven't had the money or funds to update them, to do routine maintenance and so forth.
Yeah, that gets tricky. I mean, I think that we all have this fantasy that we're going to buy this house and it's not going to need anything while I live there. And so sometimes we run our budgets a little tighter than we should, or life happens. Maybe, you know, you start having a child that gets into school, you know, requirements, you know, anything from tutoring to maybe club sports or whatever. And so those numbers, you keep yourself really tight where you don't have that window of extra cash to make any repairs. And so they get deferred. And then all of a sudden you have a house that's, you know, basically in a tough spot that it's going to take thousands to fix instead of hundreds. And then, you know, all of a sudden life happens and you get hurt or you lose a job. But anyway, I mean, this is a small, relatively speaking, this is a very small percentage of the real estate market. I want to make that crystal clear, because I don't want to sit here and you know, come across on the radio like today we're saying that there's all these foreclosures coming or whatever. It's more or less people being proactive with their financial situation they're in and using someone like yourself to help them get through that hurdle of life. And it is a very small percentage, but you just wanted to come today and really tell us a little bit about how you help people.
You know, that's right, Andy. And I think that today people don't realize that there is this help available. And actually, short sales, a lot of people are still getting a relocation incentive of up to $3,000 for selling on a short sale. All the lenders are still...
Yeah, elaborate a little bit more on what that means. So this is, you know, somebody that's they're trying to sell, they don't have the money.
Right, they're trying to sell, and typically in a short sale, there's no, you know, you're underwater, so you're not getting any proceeds. But mm-hmm. here, the lenders are allowing proceeds to as an incentive to sell on a short sale.
To help you with the moving expenses.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's cool.
And actually, the turnaround time has been shrinking. I mean, it used to be, there's all that horror story of 6 months to get a short sale. We're seeing approvals by lenders in 90 days or less.
And they seem to be doing more reasonable things. I mean, they used to really make you, I don't know how to say overprove, but there seems to be like the banks are being more realistic with the bigger picture. They're not just looking at, you know, oh, hey, they're choosing to do this. They actually do need to do this. And they're not digging as deep, and they're not, you know what I mean? I guess, I don't know.
I think you're right, Andy. I think they've made a conscious decision that getting these homes sold and avoiding foreclosure is best for the lenders as well.
And the communities. And I think communities. Avoiding the foreclosures is a key thing there, guys, because I think that we all sit there and think about that. And a foreclosure is just, it's a bad mark to put on a community. And it just, what it does is it just says, hey, somebody failed. And the housing market here isn't worth fixing or whatever, you know, just all the negative, you know, thoughts that come with it. So having somebody that, you know, gets the help, gets out of the situation, keeps the integrity, the values in the neighborhood high, and keeps us moving forward with housing, because I think that's a big part of all of our, you know, wealth.
And I think even for the seller, it's a win in a difficult situation. You know, they finish up as the best they can, mm-hmm. and move on.
Recoup pretty quickly too. I mean, typically you can kind of get back into the game. I mean, if it goes all the way to foreclosure, I mean, what is it, 7 years, I think?
Yeah.
But if it's a short sale, I mean, you could be in, depending on what the reasoning is, right, or what your hardship was, I mean, a year to 2 years.
I think so, definitely. Yeah. And it depends how much you're putting down and the type of program. But you know, for
sure. Well, and then back in the day, too, I mean, some of these lenders that were in second positions, for them to forgive their debt, they would force you to file bankruptcy or whatever, or they wouldn't forgive it unless you were in bankruptcy because they didn't want you to have any shot at getting out of this and surviving with even a nickel. And nowadays, it's just, like I said, it's just, it's a little more humane.
It really is. And so I people should really think about that. I think people may be suffering in silence when they could actually talk to someone, you know, talk to a real estate agent, find out where your house is. And like you said, Andy, try to be proactive.
And yeah. What does that cost us, Jeff? I mean, like, you know, and I'm not trying to make this an infomercial, but those that are listening that have a friend or a family member that need help, Jeff, how do they get a hold of you? And then what can they anticipate for your services? How does that all work?
Well, it's a no-charge consultation to start. So that there's no charge there. The fees are mainly out of the sale proceeds. So there is a very small to no payment by the consumer. It's basically a sliding scale based on their hardship.
And the banks really have agreed that, hey, let this person get an attorney to work with them. And then they end up paying out of the proceeds to the attorney.
That's basically what's happening. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. You know, we talk about these houses and, you know, that typically they just don't have the money to fix them up, or they, like you said, they've neglected that maintenance. Mm-hmm. That kind of brings up to me a market segment out there that I call the teenage homes. You know, those homes that are kind of in that 13 to 16, 17 years of age, and things start happening. You know, teenagers go crazy sometimes. We start losing water heaters and we start losing furnaces and the roof isn't as good and all of that kind of stuff. And then that is something, you know, that people are looking at. And I tell you, if you're selling your house and you have made those updates in that price point, you know, because there's some people who, how they take care of their stuff is better than how other people take care of it. But
for sure,
if you're one of those that didn't quite take care of it and you have all that new stuff, that just kind of gives you a plus over the other ones that haven't done that, because mm-hmm. you're going to have repairs.
Right. I mean, that's expected. I think that you're, you know, I was only chuckling because, you know, there's consumers that will come out in their houses, let's even say 50 years old, and they have a new furnace, new water heater, new windows, new roof, new siding. They have, you know, all of the house is brand new. And they're usually the ones that are the most reasonable on what they want to sell their house for price-wise. And then you go out to the neighbor that invites you over to sell their place, and they have nothing done, and they want the same price. And so buyer beware, this is where you want to have a skilled set of eyes when you're buying those houses in that price range and in that age range, that you are looking at those, hey, what other big, you know, expenses could be coming with this property? Because I'm telling you, there are better deals out there than just what's for sale. And so sometimes you'll see the ones that have all of that. And even if it's not the perfect house, it's worth the investment because all the big expenses are already paid for, or the assessments are paid off, or the whatever. And those are all real expenses to you as a buyer.
Yeah, you're not kidding. So, you know, we do have text questions. We can grab one here. So I think this one's kind of funny. Oh, I'm not talking into my mic?
No.
Okay. I was looking at the screen. Should a real estate agent have to return my calls after 9 p.m.? Kind of interesting.
Is this from my clients?
Yeah, exactly. You know, comes up that everyone thinks that realtors should be available at all times.
Well, let me put it to you this way. You're talking to a guy that I try to stay awake till 10 o'clock, and I do keep myself available. I set the cell phone next to me, but I fall asleep at 9 o'clock. But I'm also up at 5. So when you send me a text.
Say that into the microphone a little louder.
When you send me a text at 10 o'clock at night, I am going to respond to that at 5:15 in the morning. So be prepared. So then I'm going to say, well, why aren't you up at 5:15 if I'm not up at 10? So the thing is that it's I start early and kind of end at that 8, 9 o'clock. But I am available. I mean, yeah. Most people know me, say, hey, just text Andy quick. Hey, I got a question. Can you call me? Or whatever, and that makes it easier. But if it's something important, absolutely, yeah. I'll pick up the phone.
Well, I think sometimes what happens is that, you know, hey, if it's to call and say, you know what, we forgot to bring the garbage out, you know, yesterday, and there was a showing, and you're talking about that, that's different than, hey, we've got an offer on the house, and we're in the middle of negotiations, you got to get it done.
Right.
You know, so that does happen, but no, I think realtors also have a life as well.
Well, you know, but be realistic. I mean, I think that it's not, you know, it's not a 24/7 business, even though sometimes we act like it is, because
I think it's the agents that kind of throw that out there.
I was just
call me
say,
anytime. I'll show you a house every day.
Right,
every
here's
second,
my cell phone. You can call me. I'll answer during dinner. That's great. That's their integrity set. That good for them. I mean, but there's a lot of people that you can last longer in this business if you have boundaries and good boundaries, right? Or if you say, hey, this is when I am available. I'm available. Send me a text if there's an emergency. But for regular business questions, most people can conduct business hours. But then I also work weekends, so I expect to get texts all weekend long, Saturdays and Sundays, and it doesn't bother me anymore. So.
I think it's just setting expectations of what it is, and so you're on the same page. Break time.
Very good. All right, we have another half hour or so to go on the Real Estate Show, so stay with us. Welcome back to the Real Estate Show here again, Chris and Andy.
Okay, we're back. And what would a segment of the Real Estate Show be without Andy's trivia?
I wanted to add an international flair, gentlemen.
Really?
Yeah.
All right, let's hear it.
Okay, so there was a first time for everything. European countries where people expect not to be able to buy their first property until they're a certain age. So what that means is obviously when they surveyed a bunch of people, they said, hey, when do you think you'll be able to afford to buy a house? Okay. In Turkey, they said they can buy a house when they're as young as 17.
Really?
Yeah. France, they had to be an average of 35 before they thought they could afford with the down payments and the cost of the houses. In the UK, it was 41, and the highest is Germany. They were 45 was the anticipated age that they'd be able to afford their first house.
Wow.
Otherwise, they're renters.
Yeah.
So in America here, when we sit there and we make fun of America, I go, boy, the opportunities are here if you want.
What would you say America would say? I know that's probably not in your trivia.
It was not listed.
Ledger
Thank
here.
You for asking. Yeah. I did not pull that stat.
I think people would say, what would you think, Jeff? Maybe 25 to 28.
I was thinking the same, 25 to 28.
So that's an attorney saying. So
where do you guys think the world's largest home, single-family home, is located?
The largest?
Jeff, you can get involved too if you want.
Turks and Caicos.
Nope.
Monterey.
It's Mumbai, India. It's 400,000-square-foot skyscraper owned by
400,000?
An oil and gas tycoon named Mukesh Ambani. And they estimate his house to be worth $2 billion.
Wow.
Yeah, he's got his own skyscraper. Here's a more fun one. In Scotland, why do people paint their front doors red?
It had something to do with the wars, right? Because I got an agent of mine that was in Ireland, and he painted his door orange. I said, you can't do that when you sell.
It's not Amsterdam.
And he explained it. tell me. Oh, geez. Jeff maybe had an idea.
Maybe they just have a lot of red paint around.
You guys are really clever. In Scotland, they paint their doors red as a sign that they have paid off their mortgage.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So those that have their doors, we should start doing that.
There was
here.
Something like in Ireland or something. There's some war or something. They all had to have the same colored doors, and then they started getting crazy colors.
Oh, cool.
I can't remember. So there's my trivia.
Nice.
Not verified trivia.
Well, but still fun. Well, you know, there was one other fun fact. So Sears, we talk about how much we order stuff online today. So I looked back and I was looking up Sears, and they, you know, back when it was rail car based, between 1908 and 1940, how many houses do you think Sears sold by rail car? Or as they call mail order houses? What would be your guess?
There was a ton.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
70,000 houses were sold.
Wow, by rail car.
By rail car. By Sears, yeah. Who, you know, now we've got Craftsman left of that. You know, it's kind of crazy how times change, but, you know, talk about the ultimate online order. I mean, I don't know how Amazon would ship that same day, but I'm sure they'd figure it out.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Let me ask you a question. Where do you think the most expensive mobile home was sold in the country last year?
It's covered. A mobile home?
Mobile home. The most expensive mobile home was sold last year for $545,000 in Aspen, Colorado.
Wow. I was going to say San Diego.
Yeah, there's a ton out in California, too. And there are a lot of
those. So that mobile home sitting on 50 acres on the top of Vail. Maybe.
I didn't get that detailed. Yeah. I hit the highlights. But yeah, I'm sure it's pretty fancy. Yeah. It seems like a lot for a trailer.
Okay. Should we move away?
Please.
Should we get into some real estate here?
I'm getting bored with myself.
You know, a question we have a lot, and glad you're here, Jeff, is, and we'll move away from short sales a little, but are on easements and encroachments. Can you explain what the difference is between those two?
Well, an encroachment, first of all, is when you have something on your property that is on the neighboring property over the property line, like your fence, or you have like a shed, or vice versa.
Landscaping,
the,
even irrigation.
The neighbor has it on yours. Now, an easement is giving someone permission to have that, could be permission to have that encroachment. And then they actually are allowed to have it there, or it's to give right-of-ways for drainage or utility lines or things like that. But then there's an actual permission given for those fixtures, facilities to be there.
You know, a lot of easements that we hear about, I mean, especially when you're maybe on acreage parcels, are driveway easements, where maybe they're doing shared driveways, but it's somebody's land and there's an easement on there. What are the concerns for a potential purchaser of a house that maybe, hey, that's not my land and I've got an easement to my house?
Well, you know, it is that the accuracy of where the driveway is compared to the easement, if there actually is an easement. Because a lot of times, especially around lake properties and acreages, well, they just kind of built the driveway wherever they made sense, and they didn't actually put it in the easement. It's also a good idea to really walk a property and see if there is signs that someone is using the property. And then if there is, to really find where are the boundaries. I mean, I've even seen pools where the neighbor built a pool and it was half across the property line. I mean, these things are way more common than you would think.
Yeah, and typically a lot of people even go through it and never even know that it's there until it's too late.
That's right. That's right. Or they don't know that the previous owner and the neighbor had always allowed this. They had allowed this fence, or they had allowed this. But it never comes up. It just never comes up.
What about if it's just in a residential neighborhood? You have a neighbor that maybe his driveway, you know, goes over the property line or a fence, like you said. I mean, can you as a good neighbor just live with that and not say anything? Or do you have to object immediately to make that enforceable? Or can you 10 years when you go to sell your house, tell them that you want it moved?
Well, there is a period of time when if you allow another party to sort of adversely, they call it, possess your property, that they may have a claim to it. But I would say it never gets better with time. Usually if something like that is going on, you should really address it as soon as you can. Mm-hmm. Either give them permission and have an easement or tell them to move it. Because when you are ready to sell your home, you don't want to start this process because it could take some time to get an easement put of record. Or if there is a dispute, so the sooner you settle it, or let's say that the neighbor that you're friendly with moves and then the next neighbor is not so friendly.
Right.
So the sooner that you address these things, usually it's better.
We had actually a situation a couple years back where there was a sprinkler. And the sprinkler head came up, and it was on the neighbor's property. And what the neighbor said was, you know what, as long as it's here, I don't want to move it, and you don't care if it's there, I'm going to put in a 360 head on there, so I'll just water your yard on this side of the house for you, and left it. And they moved, and they thought it was a great thing. The new guy moves in and says, uh-uh, I want your stuff out of my property. I want, you know, and so that was where I bring that up, because that's kind of common.
Well, if you agree to that kind of stuff, I mean, that's a big part of the disclosure statement.
You bet.
Put that on the disclosure. So, all right, got to go.
We have to do a quick break. We have more show to come, more of the Real Estate Show here on News Talk 830 WCCO. And let's get the final segment in of the Real Estate Show here on CCO Radio. Here again, Chris and Andy.
Okay, we're back. Andy, I got a question for you. So all those things we're talking about with easements and encroachments, yeah. And we all know that as agents, we're always, hey, fix this, and do that, and it costs some money to do. But do you think in the case of, hey, maybe you have a shared driveway, to get a survey done ahead of time?
I think it's a great idea. What ends up happening, though, is everybody says it's a great idea until they say it's $500, $600, $700 to have it done, you know. What I may suggest you do is go down to the city and look for what they call as-is survey. They may have one on site, and generally they'll have locations on that plat where there's going to be circles on there that are hollow. Those usually are just points of interest. When they're filled in on the survey, it shows there's a pin in the ground. And so there's actually a pin put in by an engineer that was on site. And so you can usually dig down and find that pin yourself and save the money and then leave it exposed. Or some people will actually put a little like red post in the ground or something to let you know that it's there for the new buyer to visually see it. But otherwise, yeah, if you don't have that available to you, you do want to probably employ somebody that knows what they're doing.
Yeah, I just think it's a real smart thing. But it is. It's kind of like, hey, if you live on acreage, hey, let's get the well tested right away and let's get the septic certified. But people don't like to put money in at the beginning. They think, oh, we can always do that if we sell it or when we sell it. But I think having that knowledge up front and knowing exactly what you're dealing with, I think is a big thing. I think that helps. What do you think, Jeff?
Oh, I think so, too. And I think that the time it takes to get those things done when you're under the gun, you already have the property sold, it just makes the whole process more hectic and more difficult as well.
And I always say, too, that your leverage is when you haven't sold it yet. Mm-hmm. If you've sold it, now all these problems come back later. You don't have any leverage. You got to defend yourself because you could always say, hey, then we're not going to sell it. But if you get people in the mindset, hey, this is what it is, and that's what a disclosure statement really is, and that's why you have to have it before you write an offer, is because then people know exactly what they're getting into.
Well, and I think, I get it. You don't want to spend the money unless you have to, or if it doesn't sell, then you have to order it 6 months down the road or whatever, like for well and septic inspections. But I'm telling you, if you're putting the house on the market, you need to be prepared and be – you have to think positive. You have to think this house is going to sell. It's going to sell in 30 to 60 days. I have to be prepared for the sale. And yep, I do have to make a slight investment into the property to make it easy for somebody to come and buy my house. When you make it difficult to buy your house, guess what? They usually make their offer difficult. They lower the price or they'll come at you from a different angle that, well, we want the free whatever. And so I would say the easier you make it for someone to come in and fall in love with your house, visualize it as theirs, and you make it easy, the better the offers are.
The more the clarification, the more the comfortability, meaning that they'll typically pay you more because they're more secure in it and you won't have as many problems going on.
Yeah. Easier to land a plane with clear skies, right?
Jeff, disclosure statements. I mean, all the lawsuits are really based on that and what maybe the seller stated or didn't quite state. I mean, typically that's what we see all the time, isn't it?
You know, we do. And I always tell sellers, don't guess. If you thought you redid your roof 5 years ago, check it, or otherwise say you're not sure. Because if it was 10 years ago, pets is another one,
right?
And the cats, but they were never upstairs, and then
the dander gets blown up there through the vents.
So I always say, don't guess. Be very careful that what you do say you are sure about.
I get that question a lot more now. We get calls before they look at the disclosure statement that's typically online, at least on the agent side. And then if it says no pets, I get a call and say, hey, just making sure that there's been no pets. They can't have pets in the house that they're going to buy.
Yeah, I know. And I've heard sellers say, I had the cat 12 years ago and I replaced the carpet and repainted the house. So there's no signs of a cat in this house. I go, yeah, but when you lived here, did you have a cat in the house?
What about the visiting cat? The visiting cat that came over the weekend.
Does that happen a lot?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. No, I mean, you know what I mean? That say someone leaves town, they say, hey, you take care of my dog for the weekend. And a seller might be like
dog sitting?
Yeah. And the seller might be like, no, we never had any pets,
maybe talk a little bit about why people don't buy houses with pets. I mean, it's dander. They're allergic or whatever. So I don't want to expose somebody that has an allergic reaction. Nobody wants to hurt anybody intentionally, but it's, at least I think, and in my fantasy world. The idea there is that you don't want to disclose that, even if you do have. And if you explain it and somebody says, you know what, we'll take that risk. Remember, a disclosure statement is strictly a tool that's used for them to help them make a buying decision. And so if you guide them incorrectly, they're making the buy incorrectly, and then they will be mad at you. So if you do everything correctly or above board or say, I don't know, make your own decision,
Yeah. Yeah, that disclosure statement is so important. We always tell people, take your time on that thing. And we always give it at the very beginning. And so what we do is, hey, take your time, look at it. If you have any questions or clarifications that you need help with, then we can talk about it. Obviously, realtors cannot fill in that disclosure statement. They're not marking the boxes for you and doing all that stuff. You have to do it yourself. But And if you don't know, I mean, something like you were just talking about that roof. If you're in a city, call the city. I mean, they're more than likely have records. There's a lot of online records that you'll see that where the roofing permit was done. And I'll tell you what, when you go on that disclosure statement and you say, hey, roof was put on April of 2017 versus just 2017, it just gives that buyer a bigger sense of just comfort.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and you know, with permits, we've had several people ask, you know, hey, I want copies of all the permits. And then I think a buyer sometimes gets confused that the cities have these big, elaborate records of photographs and conversations are written down of what's been approved or not approved with the city codes. And it's just not the way it works. They literally come out there and either you pass or you fail, and they tell them what they need to do to pass. And so you want to read your local city code, too, to make sure that the city codes are up to what you'd consider your standards. And so you can, when you're making that buying decision, reflect your best interests. So,
yeah. So, our little site has been getting a lot more views, Andy. Do you know that? AndyandRooney.com.
I mean, yes, it is.
Yeah, but what's nice about it is that a lot of things that we talk about, we put on that site, all the guests that we have, go on there. So if you have to, if you're thinking maybe, hey, there is a short sale issue here, Jeff, all your information's on there. But if you want to give them another, maybe a direct number or a website, that would be great.
Sure, Andy. Sure, Chris. I can. My website is mzlaw, www.mzlaw.us. I'm Jeff at mzlaw.us.
That's an easy one. That's a
it
good
is.
One.
It is.
That's better than AndyAndRooney.com. But
I don't think
that's
so.
That's what ours is.
I think we're. No.
What else you got going, Andy?
Well, open houses this weekend, and obviously good luck to everybody that's out there doing their deer hunting. It's a big ritual for a lot of families, and hope you do well, everybody. And then we'll see you next week.
Yeah, check us out at andyandrooney.com.
We'll do that very thing. Thanks, guys. We'll see you next Saturday morning here on News Talk 830 WCCO.